And one of the, another sort of underlying feature in terms of migration and displacement is being able to talk about this apartheid system, this essentially this global apartheid system that is able to essentially displace people due to war, colonization, the so-called globalization, development, all of this is able to displace people both in the fourth world and the third world, and in the so-called name of, you know, bringing democracy, whatever it happens to be. I'm sure we're all familiar with it. And then be able to say that people who migrate, whether it is people who migrate from the third world to the territories of Canada and North America, or Indigenous people who continue to be displaced off their lands into urban areas and dispossessed of their land, are basically denied any status. Right? All Indigenous people are relegated to an Indian status card. There's a growing resistance movement to no longer register people under the Indian Act, but if you don't do that, you're essentially non-existent in the system. It becomes completely impossible to try to access healthcare, social services, any of that, unless you happen to be part of this colonial system. That's certainly the same for numerous undocumented, over 100,000 undocumented people who live without status in Canada and who are unable to access anything. It's important to note that our economies completely depend on non-status labor. It completely depends on it. People are not relegated to become undocumented for no reason. Just one story. People might be from Montreal might be familiar with the story of Shamim Akhtar, who was a Pakistani woman who was deported from Canada to the U.S. and is currently living in New York. And right now in New York, she's not undocumented. She's going through the refugee process, but prior to her actually beginning the refugee process in the U.S., she doesn't have papers. And she described, over the past, it's been almost a year now since she was deported from Canada, and for the past year, she's described how much money the system makes off of people like her. Her employers will say, you are undocumented. There is no reason for us to pay you. You cannot go to any employment labor board. You cannot go anywhere. And so they're definitely an ununionized, temporary, part-time, completely vulnerable positions that they're working at. One example, for example, is her partner. He worked in a job in a farm from, essentially, he used to go to work at 4 p.m. and return at 5 a.m. in the morning, so that's 11 hours a day. He worked there for 2 weeks. He worked 6 days a week, so 12 days for 11 hours a day, and he made a total of $230. That's what he got at the end of 2 weeks. This is certainly not an uncommon story, right? This is what Canada and the U.S. And all settler states depend on. And after 9/11, we're obviously all becoming increasingly aware of security regimes and anti-terrorism legislation, and there's this sort of growing discourse that, oh, the anti-terrorism legislation will affect anyone. As all Canadian citizens, we need to be beware of the anti-terrorism legislation because it affects all of our civil liberties. Well, yeah, that might be the case, but let's look at who has affected. The first action under the anti-terrorism legislation was used in BC against Natanis, who is who's an Indigenous warrior who has been documenting the Native youth movement struggles. She's a film director. Her partner is part of the Red Warrior Society and the Warrior Society. Their house was raided in Port Alberni in 2002. That was where the anti-terrorism was used, right? The ability to construct Indigenous people now as the domestic terrorists. So you have all the foreigners, all the Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians who are the foreign terrorists, and you have Indigenous people who are being constructed as the domestic terrorists, and this goes back very deeply to this idea of racism. And if we look at sort of World War II, when you had the extremely well-known now internment of the Japanese Canadians, and obviously also happened with Japanese people of Japanese descent in the U.S., the ability to intern that many people depended on the ability to suddenly say that Japanese people are not loyal Canadians, right? To be able to say, well, they're just hyphenated citizens. They're Japanese Canadian, they're Indo-Canadian, they're South Asian Canadian, they're Arab Canadian. They're not really Canadian enough because the only people who are Canadian enough are white Canadians. Everyone else has the potential of being a terrorist, has the potential of becoming unloyal. And so you see that in that history, all the way from, you know, definitely even before the Japanese internment, and now with the anti-terrorism legislation, depends on being able to say that people are not going to be loyal, to say that they're not entitled to all of this, these sort of aspects of due process. And then obviously another well-known use of anti-terrorism legislation is the security certificates, which people might be well familiar with, and that's security certificates have been used prior to 9/11, but are being increasingly used in the post-9/11 climate. And it's essentially five men are being held without charge. None of them currently have any charges against them, without due process. They're not allowed to see the evidence against them. Their lawyers aren't allowed to see the evidence against them. Adel Sharkawi was recently released on bail, but for years all of them have been struggling to even get out on bail, to be able to see their families. And again, the ability to say that these five Muslim, they're not Canadians, they're refugees and immigrants, landed immigrants, are unloyal and unpatriotic and have it become normalized in Canada and have people not even blink an eye about this. It's predicated on this colonial system and racism. And another just sort of last example about that is that 2 years ago there was a lot of talk about implementing the national ID card, and there was a whole talk about Denis Coderre, the then Minister of Immigration, introduced it, and there was a lot of talk about biometrics being on it and being able to cross-reference databases with criminal records, medical records, people if they'd access social services. And, you know, sort of all these Canadians spoke out against it, saying this is a brutal invasion of our privacy, this cannot happen. And then now in the past year, you see the national ID card sort of refashioned in the face of what are now smart cards coming up in Mohawk and Cree territories. And no one blinks an eye about it because it's not happening to Canadians, right? It's not happening to what people think are Canadians. It's also been privatized. I'm sure people in IPSM are working on it. We'll have more details on it. But just the ability to do that and there be no resistance to things like this is quite insidious. And so this colonial foundation and racism, it's so deeply seated in Canada that it's become normalized. It's become so normalized that we live on occupied territories, that we don't live in a militarily occupied territory. So it's able to say, well, we don't live on occupied territories. We don't. There's no military occupation. There's no bombs. There's no bullets. But the worst part about it is, we do. And it's so normalized and so insidious that all we're left with is essentially this human rights discourse that, let's just make sure there's more human rights for Indigenous people. Let's just make sure there's more human rights for immigrants and refugees. Let's not worry about trying to dismantling the fact that we live on colonized territory. Let's not try to dismantle the fact that these communities live under colonial laws. Let's just make sure that we have maybe some better laws, maybe give them some more money, maybe repeal a couple of laws here and there, but let's not worry about anything beyond that. Ward Churchill, I know, has talked a lot about this because he spoke last year in Vancouver, and he was saying that one of the things that is sort of most poignant is that in the anti-war movement, we can talk about, Canadian government and Canadian troops and Canada out of Haiti. We can talk about Canada get out of Iraq, Canada get out of Afghanistan, stop Canadian complicity in the occupation of Palestine, but we are unable to say and articulate a position on Canada get out of Canada. We cannot do that. And that's very poignant because that is what our position must be. If we are going to be against war and occupation around the world, we're against Canadian occupation here, which means being able to say and articulate a decolonization movement that says Canada off Indigenous territories, Canada off occupied lands in the fourth world and the third world. Just one quick quote from Ward that sort of sums up his, and I think quite well, an articulation of it, is if we oppose globalization and all that it signifies, we have to understand what it is that makes it possible. And what it is that makes it possible, because do not misunderstand the nature of the beast. Its locus is right here on Turtle Island. It's right here in North America. We can fight in the hinterland. We can profess solidarity with people in opposition to its ravages out there somewhere all we want. But we're fighting symptoms rather than causes. The belly of the beast is where we are. So in terms of building this decolonization movement here in the belly of the beast, occupied territories, Fortress North America, all the sort of language that's been thrown around for quite a while. That encompasses both an anti-war analysis and an anti-globalization analysis worldwide means being able to build it here, because this is where the struggle is. And I just want to wrap up with just some stuff that we've been working on. As Nazila mentioned, I'm involved with the Land Freedom and Decolonization Coalition in Vancouver, whose name was aptly ripped off for this conference, although we spent hours coming up with that name, or slightly changed. It's a coalition of a wide variety of immigrant and refugee organizations from various communities, the Chinese community, the South Asian community, the Colombian community, Chilean community, and a whole vast of others, and different native youth movements and different sovereigntist movements. Well, the first thing that we did that when we came together as a coalition was we actually organized around July 1st of last year. And obviously July 1st, which is celebrated across Canada as whatever it is, Canada, I don't know what people do on Canada Day. But obviously for Indigenous people, it has huge ramifications, but some people may or may not know, but July 1st in 1923 was the day when legislation, the Chinese Exclusion Act, was passed into the Chinese community. It's known as Chinese Humiliation Day, or Shame Day, because that was the predecessor for all the slew of legislation, the Chinese head tax and the Chinese Exclusion Act, where Chinese people were no longer allowed in Canada until about three decades later. So we organized around that and sort of a sharing of experiences of the Chinese Canadian community and Indigenous peoples in Canada struggling against colonialism. Is that for me? It is. No, that's all right. which has been very, very powerful. And that's continued with a lot of work that we've done. Art Manuel, who's also Shukwamuk, like Arnie is, he was telling us a story about a few months ago where he was telling us that in the early 1900s, when all the race riots were happening in Chinatown in BC, in Chinatown in the early 1900s, a group formed called the Asian something that was exclusionary, but they didn't quite call it exclusionary. Basically, the Asian Exclusionary League, not quite exclusionary. And that league formed, and there was race riots from 1910 to 1912, and Chinatown was completely destroyed, and there was this sort of panic about, you know, Chinese people coming in and taking white people's jobs, because at that point, the railroad was getting done, so we had to kick out all the cheap Chinese labor, make sure they still weren't around. And he was sharing stories about how a lot of the Musqueam and Squamish nations around that area were able to host and bring and take in a lot of the Chinese community who were facing these race riots. And that's been an important part, because a lot of times in terms of our communities, a lot of the education between migrant communities and Indigenous communities is facilitated basically through a colonial education system. And we end up internalizing a lot of the same stereotypes that white people want us to believe about each other. And being able to have an independent relationship that basically is independent of other colonial settler education systems and relationships has been very, very, very important, because it's a whole sort of theme of this conference is talking about decolonization and mutual aid and self-determination and self-determining communities. And these are two very strong self-determining communities who have been struggling for decades against Canadian colonial systems, and being able to do it together and share our stories has been quite great. Some people might know Janice Billy. She's a spokesperson of the Chippewa Protection Center. One thing that, sort of one slogan that she's been using a lot lately is she says that our Indian people are refugees on our own land. And a lot of that has come from the ability to share and talk about what is the refugee experience, what is the migrant experience, what is the experience of being forcibly displaced from your territories, and these similarities, obviously, with Indigenous people. And there's been a lot of talk about being able to have refugees seek asylum on reserves. Obviously, the legalities of that are a bit sketchy, but in theory, it's obviously quite symbolic. So those are some of the concrete sort of examples that people have been working on and sharing on, because that's the process that needs to happen. That's building the decolonization movement, is being able to share these struggles and articulate our histories in a way that emphasizes the resistance and is able to build on each other and support each other. So that's about it.